Hello and welcome to Unparliamentary Language, a podcast that will try to stop spewing sewage into your ears every few weeks. And how are you, Rob?
Yeah, I'm very well. I've just talked about Bond in the pre-episode, so I am hyped up, ready to go. You can't stop me talking now. I'm on a Bond train, and I'm good to go.
Presumably some kind of train with large Russian symbols on it that will get shot at by a tank later on in the episode. some very specific references today.
Ram him!
Yeah. I think strawberries. For people who like Bond, Patreon special episode where we were just chatting about having just seen No Time to Die, spoiler-free-ish. None of the major spoilers. Anyway, feel free to go and check that out on Patreon. It always drops just before the episode comes out. So, you know, in some ways, following the Patreon is a way to know I'm about to drop an episode on you a day later. I think we should move straight on into the headlines because we've chatted enough about other things. So first up, we have Kicked in the Scallops by the Daily Star. What's that about, Rob? Sorry, that is a great headline I had not seen on this topic.
It's a great one. Trust the Daily Star to come up with a headline that gets straight to the point. This is about the growing fishing row that is kind of like a byproduct of Brexit that's been happening between the UK and France. And it's one that I've seen it rumbling on in the papers, but I didn't know exactly like why it started or how it started. So I got myself a really good explainer article. Essentially, what's happened is that when we were in the EU, both Britain and France's fishing rules were all controlled through the EU, right? We knew where to go for our papers and to get permission to fish in each other's seas. And that was all fairly cordial. Now, of course, we have left the EU. And so we had to renegotiate parts of that deal, particularly with France, who share our waters. And essentially, both sides are getting a little bit pickier about who can fish in their seas. So there were two trawlers. One was actually detained in Calais. The other one was given a warning because it didn't allow French officials to board it, essentially, so they could check if they had the right licenses to fish in those French waters. France say that they are perfectly legally entitled to do this because this is part of the Brexit deal. Whereas the UK think that the French are being a bit too fastidious about that. And, you know, boarding and keeping a vessel in one of their French ports, a vessel that belongs to Britain, is an unnecessary raising of tensions. To add to this, you also have the fact that there are individual fishing rights given by Jersey and Guernsey, which, of course, are little islands off the coast, well, in between France and Britain. They give out their licenses separately to how France administers their licenses or the rest of the UK does. And there have been disputes about which French vessels can fish there or not. And so it's a little bit of a tit for tat row as the two countries try and work out where they can have their authority over fishing rights. And it's been, in my opinion anyway, it's kind of been blown up in the papers more to the fact that if you read the Daily Express or the Daily Mail, you think we might be about to go to war over these fishing vessels. Personally, I don't think that will be the eventual consequence of it, but it's certainly showing where it's those little things around the edges, as we've talked about with Brexit, where things were once a bit simpler because we all shared, we all knew where to get our licenses from, and there was a bit of good faith when it came to those fishing vessels being able to fish in their waters. Maybe the French weren't quite as fastidious about checking licenses for the British as they were when we were part of the EU. Now it appears everybody's getting a bit more like, you know, oh no, you've got to show your papers, please. And we've seen that with the sausage battle that we had in Northern Ireland, where EU officials weren't allowing certain meat to transfer into Northern Ireland because it would go against rules set out in the Brexit deal. Like, yes, those rules are in place, but how the Brexiteers would say, oh, you don't want to break the deal just because of a couple of sausages, do you? Whereas the EU is very much like, no, you signed a deal, you keep up to the deal, we will keep enforcing this. So yeah, I think we're likely to see more of these tit-for-tat exchanges, but it's certainly a story that seems to be getting more coverage in the press and is one of those international stories that is looming over the next headline that we're going to look at. But certainly there is a chance for Boris and Macron to meet up and try and reconcile these differences, but it's added to the tension of this summit that's coming up.
And it's a continuing, like, we have the same story we had previously where people are saying, well, you know, we keep essentially lying on the world stage for all to see. How does that affect you know, people who might want to get into deals with us, especially when we're trying to get trade deals with various other countries? Now I get the impression quite a bit of the, like, there's a lot of kind of bluster playing to the cheap seats kind of stuff that happens. So they'll say to the EU or to France, oh yeah, we'll totally sort this out. We'll have a chat with you. And then in our, like in our newspapers, we see them being like, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, we're going to bend them over the barrel and you know, hold the possibility of our sausages, or, you know, oh, we won't send any tourists to Europe if you charge us £6 to get in, kind of thing. Not that, you know, the government controls that. I think at this point it's fair to say a fair bit of that is like bluster to the public, because, you know, it's almost like saying the ridiculous thing to get views, because people who don't like Brexit and people who don't like what the government are doing will immediately jump on it and be like, this is stupid. And it helps feed into the whole kind of culture war thing over Brexit that we've had.
Yeah, but precisely. And it's not just our side, it's not just the UK that's doing that. Macron has an election coming up as well, so it probably doesn't do him any harm to show that he's fighting the fight for the EU and for French fishermen. Like, it's there's a reason why he might bring it up as well, to try and garner some support at home. I do think it's a little bit of saber rattling and bluster, and something that I don't think will actually come to anything, but it's been talked about enough in the papers and keeps coming up as a thing that these two need to discuss, and that I feel like we needed to touch on it as a fairly important story, even if I do think it's more bark than actual bite when you look into it.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. I think a part of the benefit of this headline section is we can touch on the stories we're not going to deep dive into, but we're keeping an eye on them. If they get more interesting, we will spend time on them.
If it's war, we might mention it. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. that always reminds me of the day to day when they like managed to convince it's war. But yes. Sorry, I'm laughing now.
So right, we should probably drop that clip in the a YouTube clip for It's War. It's definitely on YouTube. I've watched it. It's hilarious. Watch the day to day.
It is. It's great. The day to day is amazing, and still amazing 20 odd years later. Excellent. So moving into our next headline, COP26, beginning of the end for climate crisis, says PM. I think most people, you know, had to be living under a rock to have not heard what COP26 is, because it has a stupid name, so everyone keeps having to explain what it is. And that starts today. We are recording on the day it starts. Mm,
yeah, but it feels like there's been a bit of a run-up.
Tell me more, Rob.
It's a climate conference that's happening in Glasgow, a meeting of 26 world leaders, including like Biden, Macron, your big CO2 producers, to try and, you know, once again, it's one of those summits where world leaders are meant to knock their heads together and come up with a solution to climate change. And there are big speeches planned by, Boris Johnson in particular, and all the world leaders, to see what they can do to try and tackle the climate crisis that is going on. Obviously, like, this hasn't happened yet, so we haven't got much to say on the conference itself. I did want to touch on the fact that in the build-up to this, there has been some embarrassing stories that have come out from the government, particularly when it comes to environmental issues. We touched on it in the joke in the to start our podcast off, but there's been a big focus on sewage and the right that water companies had to dump sewage into our seas. Essentially, there was a rule put to Parliament which 22 Conservative MPs rebelled on, which basically said, we want to stop these water companies having the ability to dump raw sewage into our waters. And the government was against this amendment, and, you know, won the vote in the Commons because it has the majority, and of course it did. But you had these 22 MPs backbench willing that they would stand up for it. The law was stopped at the Lords so it could review it. And I think since then, about 4 days ago now, the government has done a U-turn and said, actually, no, we will allow this amendment to go through. We will stop the water companies having the ability to dump raw sewage into our seas, which seems great. I mean, the fact that that was even like a possible thing that could happen is shocking. Like, it feels like we've been talking, I'm going to bring it up, like we've been talking about Bond in the pre-show, like the ability to dump raw sewage into the seas feels like the end plan of some Bond villain, doesn't it? It feels so monumentally, like, not, I mean, maybe evil's a strong term, but it just feels like something that shouldn't be allowed to happen. And why is our government allowing this to happen? And the fact that there was an amendment to stop it and the government failed to even act on that seemed very bizarre. So at least the government has taken some action on this, but it's maybe a reflection of where, the government talks a big game on climate change. And I feel that that's what we felt for a while now, or at least I have personally felt for a while, that we have these climate summits and everybody talks a big game, but the actual material consequences of those summits tends to be fairly minor in the grand scheme of things. And we've had some odd statements from Boris Johnson this week in the lead up to it. Boris Johnson has done various like visits to schools and speeches. And one of the things that's come out of it, or at least I've noticed, is he kind of says like recycling's not important really. What we've really got to do is stop our use of plastics and stop CO2 emissions. And I'm like, I'm right. You're right, Boris. I guess that we do need to stop those things. Why can't you say that we should recycle as well at the same time? Why can't you just promote a nice green message for everyone? Some of the wording over that has been confused, in my opinion. But yes, we've got this big climate summit coming up. Maybe our government not acting in the most environmentally friendly way on the lead up to it. There have been also these Insulate Britain protests that have been happening in the lead up to this, where environmental activists have been stopping cars on the road, and some of the reactions to that from both, like, you know, they are being arrested under protest rules, which you might agree or disagree about. If you want to lose faith in humanity entirely, look at the comment section of any article on the Insulate Britain protesters that are blocking the roads. So to see people's reaction to it, like, climate change is clearly a big issue and people want to do something about it. But it appears that there are still a wide variety of people amongst them, including large areas of the media, that seems to think that the climate crisis is over-egged somewhat. And I would not agree with that statement. So fingers crossed that this summit that's happening in Glasgow can go some way to reducing CO2 emissions in particular to a level that won't allow our planet to heat up by 1.5 degrees or whatever the latest statistics are. But yes, as always, I remember that. I remember one of my when I used to have Spotify that had adverts on. It was one of the there was a climate conference back in 2010, and they kept having adverts on my Spotify, kind of like saying, this is the last chance for humanity. This is the last chance that we can do anything. And I'm like, well, it's been 12 years now, and I'm being told the same thing again. I wish somebody would actually listen this time. So yeah, we'll see what happens. Apologies, that was just a big rant for me on climate change, but yeah, no go ahead, please.
That's entirely fine. I think we all agree climate change is bad and we should be doing more about it right now.
Controversial
saying, oh, we'll fix this in 10 years time, which is what every government has been saying for the last 20 odd years. I do feel like we have moved the needle a bit in that, you know, even the, as we said when we did manifestos, even the Conservatives have, you know, promised to plant more trees, etc., etc. But the Conservatives definitely promised the least stuff for climate out of all the manifestos we saw. I think famously we discussed that they even promised less than not the BNP, but UKIP, who are now Reform, promised, because like there was some really strong promises from them. And we were like, this is weird, agreeing with something that UKIP have written. The other thing I just want to link to when you were talking about the weird comments, probably the best kind of nutshell one of this is I've posted a Twitter link and it'll be in the show notes, and it's just amazing. It is a clip from a talk radio TV and this guy Mike Graham, who just does not understand, like he's talking to one of the Insulate Britain people, and he's like saying, oh, well, you're going to cut down all these trees in order to make stuff. And he's like, yeah, I'm a carpenter and we grow more trees because it's that's sustainable. That's what sustainable means. And the guy's like, mad, like, you know, just like, what? It's like he doesn't understand the point at all. Amazing.
You can grow trees, you can't grow concrete. And Mike Graham replies, yes, you can, to complete silence from the other guy. It was, give me the confidence of Mike Graham when he's wrong, please, because I don't have that much confidence in my daily life as it stands. And that man was convinced that he had really shown that Insulate Britain protester what's what, and had no idea that he was actually the fool after that encounter. It's, yeah.
It was amazing, yeah. So I think it's time to move into our main headlines tonight. So two headlines on this story. First is Sunak's spending spree from The Times. And the other one is champagne for the rich, real pain for the poor in The Mirror. What are we talking about tonight, Rob?
The budget. What else could we be talking about? It's the budget. It's the big one. It's the autumn statement from Chancellor Dishi Rishi Sunak, as I believe he's called by some people.
That's his full title, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an odd one. I think we touched on the budget last time back in April, and that was the first big kind of like post-coronavirus budget. So we knew that was, I mean, sorry, coronavirus still very much a thing. I hate saying post-coronavirus in that sense. Still very much a thing. Still wearing masks when we go out. Still remember all of that jazz. But this one we felt would be more of a turn to at least like normality. It would be less of like so focused on COVID and more of like, right, what do we do to plan for a post-COVID world and go back to that kind of stuff. So that's why it's been so interesting to see what's come out of this budget. I think maybe we'll start with just like a general overview of what's gone on. But I was really sad. This is my fault. The papers the day after are always really interesting to watch the reaction of certain papers and how they respond to it. Because you suggested originally, sorry, doing a bit of inside baseball here, but doing a budget podcast on the day that it comes out. And that's fine, but usually these budgets take a bit of time to filter through and see what people really think of it. And the headlines the day afterwards compared to the response that's been a couple of days later, I think that shows how, you know, the Chancellor says one thing and it all sounds very good, and then people look into the detail very quickly and actually go, this isn't so good. The headlines overall after that day was quite, you know, positive for Rishi Sunak. But as we'll see, some were downright wrong in the terms of The Star, who said that Rishi Sunak looking to cut taxes when actually this has been the highest taxing government since World War II as a result of this budget. So that was bizarre what the Express said. And the other thing that annoyed me about the headlines was that budgets are boring, right? They're lots of money and numbers and percentage points. So one of the best tactics used by a government will be that they'll do something to like beer or cigarettes, and people can relate to that. And we will talk about it in more detail. But essentially, there's been a slight freeze on alcohol in this budget, which led to headlines of and pictures of Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson moving barrels of beer and clinking glasses. And all of them said, "Cheers to Rishi. Fantastic. You've saved us some money on our beer." And the Daily Star, responsible for the kicked in the scallops headline, they were the only paper to lead with the fact they said that, like, this budget, I can't remember the exact headline it was, but they essentially led with the thing of like, hey, they've cut 5 pence off your beer, but the rest of this stuff is really bad. And I just wanted to take my hats off to the Daily Star for being the only paper that, like, even a broken clock is right twice a day. I don't usually agree with the Daily Star and where they come from, but with that one, I was like, you've finally seen through all this nonsense and all this like PR exercise when it comes to beer. This is actually a budget that has far-reaching consequences for both the country and, as I will go on to discuss, I think maybe what it means to be a conservative, because this, in my opinion, was not a very conservative budget.
Mm. I don't know when you want to start diving into some of the details here, but like you say, that it's kind of very traditional kind of, here's the news, here's all of the scenes. And there was a very good takedown shared by a small brewer. So essentially, I think it's a drop of 3p per pint in kegs over the size of 40 litres, I believe, is what's actually been put through. Like, as we've been talking about how this is, you know, bad taxes, you know, it's good for the rich and not for the poor. So basically, because of how independent brewers brew and ship stuff, a large number of their beers are sent in smaller kegs than that. So a 72-pint keg is like 40.1 litres or something. So 72-pint kegs, which are what people consider the traditional beer keg, and bigger, are all covered by this. However, if you're a small independent brewer, you might not be sending a full keg to a pub, especially not initially, and you might sell a lot of smaller kegs, so they're not covered. So firstly, those don't get any saving at all. But even when it is the larger saving, like, they kind of went through, this is how much beer we brew a year. So let's assume we even got it on all of the beer we brew, we'd be saving like £1,000 a month kind of thing. And then it's like, but if you look at, say, Carling, who produce 3 million pints of beer a day, and they're saving 3p on every one of those pints because they never ship anything smaller than a 72-pint keg. And it's just like, oh, suddenly they're saving hundreds and hundreds of thousands. But it's only the big businesses that are really going to see that saving from the taxes, whereas all the independent brewers aren't going to see much. And then, other than maybe Wetherspoons, where they always do the whole, look, your pint is 3p cheaper because the tax has gone down, most pubs probably won't bother to price their beer down 3p, so the end user doesn't see it. Obviously, it's good for pubs who are gaining an extra 3p per pint or whatever, but like, that's not a lot.
Yes, and like you say, I feel that it was odd that was such a headline thing, that, you know, that was that was what all the PR was about. You know, hey, good, you know, you can drink your beer and it'll be a bit cheaper, when actually, like you say, for the end service user, it might even not be cheaper and has a very negligible effect on, like, I don't know how our listeners feel. Personally, I'm like, I don't like Carling. I like a bit more of a craft beer, and that I would rather do those guys a bit of a service. I'd rather they have a little bit more of my money than the big boys when it comes to that kind of drinking anyway. So yeah, a mixed bag certainly, but it just goes to show how budgets are sometimes exercises in PR rather than actually like looking at numbers and figures. As I say, they're usually the boring bit, but I will try and cover them in our next bit when we have a look at just the general state of the economy and our finances. I will try and break that down for you and make it at least a little bit.
So Rob, what is the general state of the economy and our finances? As you set me up so well there.
So yeah, we were expecting things to be bad in general. And as always, these budgets kind of like to phrase things with like, things are bad, but they're not as bad as we predicted. So for example, one of those figures is that like unemployment is expected to peak at 5.2% next year, which is lower than the 11.9% previously predicted. Excellent. That's great news. 11.9% unemployment would have been terrible. 5.2% isn't great, but at least we won't reach that level. So that seems to suggest some recovery post-COVID. They've also said that annual growth will rebound by 6.5%, so that's good. We're seeing that upward trend of growth happening again. As we've discussed in previous budget podcasts, growth went down so much, particularly during those like big lockdown months, that we have to take these figures with a pinch of salt, but you certainly wouldn't want to see no growth coming up from that situation. So again, that's good. Wages will have grown by 3.4% since February 2020, which is also excellent news. It means that we can you know, try and stave off some of the effects of inflation. However, inflation at the moment in September is 3.1% and is likely to rise to an average of 4% over the next year. So inflation tends to look at the price of your general goods and services that you will buy. If you drive a car, you will not be immune to the fact that fuel has gone up rather a lot since you last had to drive it. Particularly for me, anyway, I feel like I would have noticed fuel prices creeping up if I was commuting every day into work. I haven't been over the past year, but suddenly you go out and drive past a fuel station, you're like, £1.48 per litre? I remember when it was £1.10, and even going over a pound, considering when I was...
Oh, I remember the queues when it went over a pound the first time, around the block. You know, it used to be when we were kids, and part of that is to do with taxing, but yeah, when I definitely remember when it went over a pound. And you compare to other countries, I mean, America is the one a lot of people compare to, where taxing on fuel is very low. And like their prices, well, they talk about prices per gallon, where we'd be quite happy to get that for a litre. Sometimes that's how much cheaper it seems to be over in the US, when you take into account the difference in the dollar to the pound and stuff like that. And then, yeah, taxation is different in different countries. Like I was able to get in 2016, which is obviously 5 years ago, I was able in Berlin to get a litre of diesel for less than a euro, which is would still be staggering in the UK at that time. I remember taking a photo and being like, look at this. This is ridiculous, to all my friends. And that's when the euro and the pound were basically the same because of the effects of Brexit, of the Brexit vote. So yeah, it is different in other places, but we have a fairly high tax on fuel that doesn't go down, and I don't think it should, because you know, that's how you try and help mitigate the climate change kind of elements, is you should be using tax raised from things that produce carbon to try and fix the problems we have, encourage electric cars and all of that. But as you say, yeah, like I think it was mid-pandemic, so there'd been like no sales. You'd have thought maybe the price would go up, but actually they had so much spare fuel. There was a few times like during the various lockdowns where I had to go and drive somewhere for an allowed reason, or they had allowed us to travel a bit further for whatever reason. And fuel was like around 115, 120 in some places, because they were just selling it off cheap by comparison. And now we got back to like kind of 130, I would say. And this is London prices, so it may be cheaper elsewhere. It's definitely cheaper in places where the fuel actually comes into the country. So like Southampton, for example, generally 5p cheaper than places around it. So yeah, we went up to about 130, but I've not been commuting at all, really, because I work in London. So I don't get the train. I don't drive, but I have, you know, pootled off to a few events over the summer as things have opened up a bit. And then when we had that crisis hit, fuel prices are now what I would call motorway prices. Today it was 142 for petrol I drove past and 147 for diesel. And normally you don't see such a difference between petrol and diesel. It's normally a penny or two more. So yeah, it is expensive out there.
And it's not just like fuel that's increased in price. Like we've seen, my weekly shop has gone up more, particularly because of, you know, food prices going up. These are all things that you have to rely on. You know, fuel and food are things that you can't just say, oh, I'm not going to buy my food this week. They're not luxuries. They're staples. They're parts of everybody's basket. So when we're talking about inflation, it's kind of just like the stuff you need to survive or the stuff that you would spend normally in a week. And if that's going up and if it's going up by 4% and wages have only grown by 3.4% in real terms, then you won't see those, you know, if there's a difference between those two, then you will start to see more and more people fall into, you know, will start to struggle with money and maybe see an increase in poverty as a result. So yeah, this was a budget which didn't spell out great things for the UK economy, although it's obviously clearly recovering post-COVID. The facts and figures that were being thrown around in the aftermath from various think tanks essentially tend to think that COVID has affected our economy and adversely by about 2.2%, whereas Brexit has affected our economy negatively by about 4%. Now, I'm sure those figures will be debated left, right, and centre, and as always, those are predictions, and predictions are often wrong when it comes to economics and forecasts, for example. But the fact that people are still already saying that the long-term impacts of Brexit and what that has meant for importing goods into the country and the negative effect that's had on our economy is more than the coronavirus pandemic, which I think we saw pretty sharply as having quite a very sharp, short effect. People are now worried more about the longer-term effects of Brexit on the economy and how that will recover, particularly when it comes to that inflation and how we can cope with rising prices if wages aren't going up in return. So yes, it's not, as I said right at the start, it's not quite our first post-COVID budget. It's still very much a thing that the government realizes that it has to pay for in the background. But now we might start to see, as time rolls on, more of these post-Brexit budgets of how well is the economy really doing. We haven't, because we left Europe in January and then coronavirus hit in February, March of 2020, we never really had a proper post-Brexit budget that's been able to take Brexit in isolation as a thing by itself. It's always been masked by the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. So yeah, as we progress into the future, I think we might see more of these post-Brexit budgets and see exactly how much our economy has been impacted.
One thing that I find interesting here is that is something we've touched on a few times. I know we've talked about that. So we were kind of hoping, one thing I would have liked to have seen is being able to clearly delineate between pre-Brexit and post-Brexit, because there's a lot of things that we were talking about pre-Brexit, you know, a lot of economic arguments for not wanting Brexit. I thought it was rash to ignore such claims by economists. And, you know, some calculations can be wrong. You know, you have to take it on balance. But generally, it looked like Brexit would be bad for us economically. And I think it's a real one of the, like, it's not the worst thing about the COVID pandemic at all. I mean, obviously, that's all the people who've died. But the not being able to have that clear line of, like, pre-Brexit and post-Brexit, I can just see this being like, you know, like people always been, oh, well, Brexit was fine, you know, it was COVID that screwed us over. And I'm like, well, that's not true, is it? Like, we've had all these issues with shipping and stuff. I mean, I know there's worldwide shipping problems, but we've had issues with stuff coming in and smaller companies not just refusing to sell stuff to the UK because of how taxing works and you know, VAT and all the forms they have to fill out. So there's definitely problems like that, but it's a much harder, more muddied message to point out to people the difference in how things were pre and post Brexit. So yeah, I think that's, it'd be nice to have that data where you can kind of show this is the negative effect Brexit had. And it's kind of slightly annoying. I mean, there's a lot of problems with the COVID pandemic that aren't, that this is a very minor one in the grand scheme of things, but it's kind of like, it would have been nice to be like, here we are a year after Brexit and we can be, it's obvious that these are the problems we had from Brexit. And it would just have answered that question. At least, I mean, it wouldn't undo Brexit, but it would allow us to discuss it in very plain terms, whereas now it's all muddied by the effect COVID had also had.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And I don't think we may never be able to fully split those things apart. So hence goes on the arguments and the culture wars. Hooray.
Yes, it'll be one of those things someone has to do in an essay in 2050 and they'll be like, oh, there's no answer. So that's an overall view you've given us. Diving in further, there's a few key things we want to pick out. So I think first one is you just talked about wages and stuff like that, but there's taxation and wages all tied together. What did we see coming out of this budget? And is anything going on with universal credit, which has been in the news a lot in recent weeks?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, the lead up to this and the big controversial thing that everybody was saying that the government couldn't take away was that extra £20 allowance that was part of universal credit that had got some people through COVID, and particularly, as I'm saying, as prices and inflation are going up, to take away that £20 would have an even more stark effect when the £20 doesn't go as far as it used to. The government's reaction to this is they are still cutting the £20, but they say the universal credit taper rate will be cut by 8%, bringing it down from 63% to 55%. So claimants will be able to keep more of the payment. Essentially, how I think universal credit works is that, you know, if you are working as well as receiving universal credit, part of the money that goes over your universal credit allowance would be taxed by up to 63%. By taking it down by 55%, it means that you have more money in your pocket after that. And from a conservative like philosophy point of view, they would say that we're not just giving out £20 to people who don't work. This rewards people for being in work and allows them to keep more of their wages, and they are taxed less severely. We can debate that till the cows come home if that is actually very effective. A lot of people have said one of the big problems with wages and 0 hours contracts in general is that you are not rewarded for being in work, or that the fact that the minimum wage being what it is not enough to live on as it stands. And that's the big problem, is the fact that, you know, wages should be higher in general to try and keep, you know, to try and encourage work and make sure that work actually pays, and that you know, if you have a job, you should be able to afford everything and be able to, you shouldn't have to rely on universal credit as well. If you are relying on universal credit and you have to work, and if you're in a full-time job, then that clearly shows something is broken within the economic system, that you can't survive on a minimum wage, which is why, as a response to that, the Conservatives have also raised the national living wage, as they call it, by 6.6% to £9.50 an hour, which they also hope will reward working a little bit more. So you can see key tenets of Conservative philosophy in the way that they have issued out those cut the universal credit taper rate and raise the living wage. They are trying to reward people being in work. They've also cut business rates by 50% in retail, hospitality and leisure centres. Clearly, those are all industries that were affected quite a lot by the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, few industries were able to escape entirely, but those are industries that particularly rely on footfall and people through the doors, and will have been adversely affected by social distancing measures and lockdown, etc. So the government is helping to try and give those businesses a bit of a kickstart. And one point on fuel, as we've said, fuel is very high. So the planned rise in fuel duty will be cancelled, because essentially the government feels that if they were to raise the fuel duty again, that would cause prices to go up even more. Inflation goes up even more. Therefore, they will not increase the tax on there. That all being said, one of the big factors as part of, you know, as a percentage of GDP, as I mentioned at the start of this as an overview, these are the highest taxes that the government has had since the end of the Second World War, which has led some conservatives to say that this is a very unconservative budget. Like in the past, when the conservatives took over after the financial crisis in 2010, austerity was the watchword of the day, and they would have cut government spending and tried to cut taxes to try and balance those budgets a bit more. And Rishi Sunak has even been on record kind of to say that, like, look, when Boris Johnson was elected prime minister, he promised to cut taxes, and as a result of corona, he's had to raise them. And Sunak's line is like, look, we're only taxing this high because we have to. We absolutely have to. We wouldn't do it if we didn't have this national crisis. However, for some conservatives, they are worried that they are becoming the party of spending a lot. There's a lot of people who are traditional conservatives who don't want the government to spend as much as they are. They want low taxes. That's the reason they voted conservative. And the fact that these budgets keep coming through where they are raising taxes worries them, and worries what it'll do for their core support, particularly if that starts to bite the hand that feeds them, if it starts to have an adverse effect on those middle income families that essentially helped the Conservatives to their 2019 election victory, then they might be starting to see a dip in the polls. Hasn't happened yet, but as I say, I don't think those taxes have really started to bite yet. I think that will start to come in 2022. So yeah, a lot of interesting questions for the Conservative Party and how they are able to balance these like rise in taxes with their general philosophy as a party.
we always knew that the kind of spending spree of COVID would have to come to an end. And we've talked a bit about how it, you know, weirdly, like while Labour often the only criticism Labour could level was they didn't go far enough during the pandemic, but they were very kind of, you know, the kind of tax breaks and things that you would expect to kind of be proposed by a Labour government. And so seeing stuff wind down, like, oh, we've lost furlough, we've lost, as you said, you know, universal credit has been modified, and so on, you know, things are going back to where they were. And then the Conservatives being the Conservatives going, you know, a bit further, but also weirdly having to increase taxing. It's interesting, kind of weird place we're in, where obviously they would have to tax more to make up for all the spending that went on. That I think everyone understood that would be the case. But when it starts hitting people's pay packet, that's when people start voting with their feet.
Yes. And Labour say, what Labour's big criticism of this, they would say that the Conservatives are increasing tax, which is something Labour would do and would have had to have done to fund their 2019 manifesto. But they are saying that they are taxing the wrong people. There is no, I think, like, bank rates were cut in this recent budget as well. Whereas Labour would say, no, we would tax the banks more. We would tax big business more. We would make sure that, you know, giants like Google and Facebook and Amazon pay their fair share of tax within the UK. We would attack those big businesses rather than having the main tax burden fall on middle to low income families, which is what the Conservatives, at least in some of their tax rises, particularly in the April budget, and now can, you know, that hasn't changed coming into this autumn budget, is where they focus their main tax rises now. So there is still a little bit of difference between the two parties in on whom they would tax and where. But in terms of actual, like, the need to raise more money to pay for COVID and other things, both those parties seem in alignment now, whereas in 2010, there was a clear distinction between the Conservatives being the party of austerity and the Labour saying, no, we can spend our way out of this crisis to try and make some economic recovery, make more of an economic recovery, more of like a Keynesian way. Where you spend that money is kind of where we've got some alignment, which is what I'd like to focus on next.
I touched a bit on spending and how much happened during the pandemic, and also, you know, kind of Labour policies and stuff like that. So what is the plan for government spending going forwards? Like, there has been a lot of rhetoric around the, you know, we need to spend some money to be able to build back better, and other phrases like that. So what's the government spending looking like, given there's these changes in taxation as well?
There will be a 1.7 billion invested in local areas for levelling up, very important for Boris Johnson. And part of his big campaign in 2019 was essentially Conservative voters felt that, the people who voted Conservative back in 2019 felt that areas outside of the big cities, outside of like London, Manchester, Birmingham, those places that traditionally voted Labour, that's where they felt the majority of funds were going. And there wasn't much going into rural communities, places that were felt equally deprived and had felt the impact of like the 2010 economic collapse, but hadn't had the reinvestment from the government. So the government is now like promising those funds to, as in their own terms, say, level up those areas. And unsurprisingly, this is quite like a popular policy, one that Labour wanted to sort of like go against initially. And then they've come round to say, oh, you know what? Unsurprisingly, people quite like the idea of having more money spent in their area on local services. So the government are trying to get some of their manifesto promises out in that 1.7 billion. There's also extra money for schools. Schools will get an extra 4.7 billion. That's been an area that has been claimed to be underfunded for quite some time. So that's quite a positive boon that the government has finally recognized that there is that crisis within schooling. I think particularly during the coronavirus pandemic, it wasn't, speaking from a personal experience, knowing some teachers, it wasn't nice to be a teacher before corona, and then during the whole pandemic, it made some of the weaknesses even more apparent, particularly when it comes to things like technology. I imagine that there's been a lot more money having to invest in, you know, making sure schools can actually provide the right technology to keep up with the demands of homeschooling and Zoom meetings, et cetera, that were happening as part of the pandemic. And probably that need for electronic learning carries on into the future. That's not, you know, computers aren't going away anytime soon. So it's good to see that money invested in education. There's an extra 6 billion for the NHS as well. Clearly the NHS has been impacted hard by the coronavirus pandemic, but we've also had this extended impact of all the surgeries that were delayed because they couldn't go ahead whilst hospitals were overrun with coronavirus patients, or at least couldn't run the risk of having those sensitive surgeries and then having patients go out and contract coronavirus. Now they are trying to get through that backlog, and in an effort to get through that backlog, the government says it was invested £6 billion of funds into those sort of projects. So yeah, there's a lot of money in a lot of places that I feel it is needed for investment. And these are type of things, you know, Labour would have been wanting more spending in education as well. They would have wanted more spending for local businesses and services. So there's little that that Labour can criticise when it comes to where that money is being spent, although naturally they might niggle over some of the side details. I just do think that where the parties differ is how that money is being raised and how they will pay for it. And as I mentioned before, like, some traditional conservatives might suggest not giving that money to you know, that they, in the past, an austerity-led government might have said, I'm very sorry, education, but we simply don't have the money for it now. You'll have to wait a little bit longer before you get those billions. The fact that the government has seen that there's such a crisis there and at least has given some money is, it might be a testament to the fact that they suddenly realise they've ignored those areas too long, or they can't go without spending that money. But yeah, it's certainly Rishi has spent more than people thought, and that's tends to be a very unconservative view of things. But I think with Boris Johnson as prime minister, he's a people pleaser. He likes to, you know, he likes to spend money because people like having money invested in their area. That's a positive thing. So it appears to me that he's at least spending now and maybe worrying about how they pay for it later on.
I'm not sure I have much to add there. They're finally realizing they have to deal with education. If I were to name like top slogans of any political party over the, you know, my lifetime, I still remember education, education, education from when I was a child. Like, that was Labour's rallying cry. So yeah, you'd think people would be aware that education is a thing you need to fund, but there have been a lot of problems, and I think we could spend a whole podcast trying to put the world to rights on the problems there are with both funding. You know, firstly, teachers are massively underpaid, which I think we're all aware of, but for the jobs they do, as they're, you know, especially as they take on extra roles, they're essentially, not only are they, you know, someone's teacher and education is important, but they're also essentially like daycare for people and things like that. There are so many roles kind of rolled into one. So yeah, hopefully some education spending comes their way soon, but yeah, I'm not confident that it's, even if the government has realised it's an important thing, I think then maybe they're saving it for pre-next general election to be like, look, we're putting all this investment into education, but sooner rather than later, I think would be good on that front. So up at the beginning, one of our headlines was on COP26. So what is the government doing in the budget in order to combat climate change? What have they proposed in the budget, given that with COP on the horizon, they must have, you know, wanted to have some good headlines come out of this?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But it's been a bit of a mixed bag on climate. The big thing that came out on climate was air travel in particular. Flights between airports in the UK are now subject to a lower rate of air passenger duty, which means that they will be taxed less. So you might see an increase in internal flights, which, considering as air travel is usually one of those big climate talking points where it's like the amount of CO2 spewed by planes out into the air and the amount of fuel that takes is a very bad thing for the climate. Us encouraging more short-term flights does seem to be a little bit counterproductive with this climate summit on the horizon, or actually happening today. They did increase the ultra long haul band for air passenger duty for flights of over 5,500 miles. So that might balance out over the long term if you're saying that short term flights are fine, but the long hauls, no, they're going to be taxed more. However, it does send somewhat of a mixed message on the eve of that. And even more than that, that was kind of the only climate news that came out before this was on this air travel thing. There was also some news about a fund being generated for these heat pumps, these heat sinks that can help insulate houses. There was a Robert Peston tweet, which I'm going to try and remember. Sorry, I didn't find it. But Robert Peston essentially did the maths on it. And he said, oh, this fund that we've got for these heat sinks will fund enough to help subsidize people buy them for around 50,000 houses, which is about 1% or 0.something% of all the houses in the UK. I'm not quite sure what massive climate impact that is going to have. Like, if you're going to go for the climate stuff, go big or go home was Robert Peston's message there. Like, you've got to have something that has a real impact. Subsidizing a very small amount of heat sinks for people on a very small amount of places in the country, and those heat sinks, however they work, they won't work for every building in the UK anyway. It seems like that was a move again, which seemed like very much more of a PR, we are doing something for the climate honest approach, rather than something that would have a real concrete impact on how the country reduces its emissions. So yes, a very mixed bag when it comes to climate, and certainly not the positive. You know, I thought the government might go for a very big green agenda with this summit on the horizon, and that they would want to go in it as like, we are leading the way in making sure that we can reduce CO2 emissions. Come on, other countries, follow our lead and do as we have. However, it appears not. And maybe going full circle to this climate summit, something we'll probably definitely cover in our next episode, it will be really interesting to see how world economies deal with climate change in a post-COVID world, or at least coming out of the recovery after the coronavirus pandemic. A lot of places might be tempted to say, we need to sort our own economies out before we go green, whereas the world appears to be saying, no, you need to sort your economies out, clearly, but we would like to do it from a greener start point. We want to make sure that we, you know, if you're investing in things, invest in green energy and green tools and renewables and create industries out of that, rather than trying to get your economy back quickly and cheaply, but doing it through fossil fuel means. It'll be really interesting to see if nations can come to an agreement on that kind of stuff, or if we just go through, like we say, another cycle of kicking the can another 10 years down the road. But personally, I don't think we can. I think the world can afford leaders to do that.
No, I think now the public are on board with that. Like 10 years ago, like you said, there was you were getting all these adverts 12 years ago for a different climate conference. And I think the average person probably wasn't thinking about it as much. Sure, there were people, you know, we've always had the Green Party bumbling along at a few percent, and they've had an MP. But I think it is much more on the average voter's mind now. Maybe not every voter, but definitely it's in the news. It gets discussed. I think most people are aware. And also it's like, you know, we've started to see, people have started to see through the tricks, you know, the fact that the carbon footprint was kind of a thing set up by BP to try and foist problems onto the average person, as opposed to onto the big companies that are actually the worst producers of all these greenhouse gases and other things. So I think the average person is now just more aware and also cares more about it. Although that doesn't necessarily translate into what the government does. At least it means there is some pressure there. The other thing I was going to say is, given that Boris Johnson has said, we want to become the Saudi Arabia of wind, which is such a stupid quote. But given he said that, it seems weird that there's less kind of money going into climate. You'd think they'd try and align the budget with, or is that just, you know, General Boris saying some random things to get in the news?
Sounds like Boris is producing enough of his own wind there for us to become the Saudi Arabia of wind. So, yeah. Sounds like a lot of hot air to me. Edit in your own joke here, please.
Yeah, I don't have a massive amount. You've done a much better job. And this is partly why I like to have this budget conversation with you, is because I can look at things, I can read the headlines. And I think, as you say, it's a benefit here of our slightly longer view. Because even the podcasts I listen to have this kind of reactionary day of the budget summary, which it sounds like with a bit of inspection falls apart quite quickly, some of the topics we've talked about. So yeah, interesting. Also, I was looking through for that Robert Peston tweet you mentioned, and I did see that there was him saying that there's talk of, you know, like you said, there's this kind of push and pull. Rishi may be saying they want to go back to the more Tory kind of tax cuts, etc., going forwards after this budget. But Boris is still, as you say, very keen on doing these big spending things that make him popular. So do we end up with this kind of weird, not as conservatives in a fiscal sense?
It's a possible splitting of the party in that sense. And you get, and it'll be interesting. Like you don't know if Boris's big spending decisions will come back to haunt him, in the fact of like, is he going to be the one clearing up that mess of taxation? Like Rishi realized that he has to pay for these things, and traditional conservatives will be saying, yes, no, we don't want to spend a lot. We actually have a duty to cut tax. That is what conservatives do. That is how we look after people. That's why people vote for us. Whereas Boris is going, no, spend, but you have to pay your bills at some point. And my worry is, maybe from personal experience of Boris Johnson's own finances, knowing that he's had to, we had that wallpaper fiasco and how his own funds are split up in various different ways. Boris Johnson doesn't appear to me, on the surface at least, as somebody who can manage his own finances very well, and seem a person who would rather spend his own stuff to make people happy rather than worry about the actual consequences of it later. And it's maybe a bit worrying to see that approach being taken to an entire entire nation rather than one person's finances as well. But we'll see how it goes.
So last week we discussed an election elsewhere. And I know we're a long way off from the elections in the UK, but I think given that we've just had the budget land, and I know you said we may not have seen that in the polls just yet, but it's still probably worth looking a bit at the polls now. I know a general election is a long way away, but it's always interesting to see the effects things have had. When was the last time we discussed the polls? Probably in May, around the election time.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Probably like post council election.
Yeah, so like in May, you can see Conservatives were doing fairly well. They, you know, especially mid May, they got to a peak of about 43%, and Labour had really dropped down below 35% on average. But Conservatives now dropped down below 40% again, and Labour are back up to 35%. Labour aren't back up to where they were in November last year, but that was pre-vaccine, and we've already talked about vaccine bumps and stuff at length. The other thing to note is while the you know, your Reform, your UKIPs, etc., are basically staying level, the Lib Dems and the Greens are also slowly rising again. So I wonder if we're in our kind of usual middle, you know, the middle period, because there, as we know, there are people who might vote for a third party who, when it's a general election, will, you know, vote for one of the major parties to make an impact. But I think we might be at that point in the polls where people are kind of settling into who they'd vote for if they knew it would make a difference. And then I suppose it's just the usual push and pull between the Conservatives and Labour. Do you have any thoughts on these polls, Rob?
I think it shows some of the underperformance of Labour in this time. Mm. It's one poll, and you shouldn't take one poll at face value. Like, you shouldn't. So I'm being bad. I'm breaking one of my own rules here. But there was a YouGov poll, I think, that I saw from the Britain Elects Twitter account that came through in the past few days. Said since the news came out that, like, the government had said they would allow sewage to be spilt into our own seas, the Conservatives have gone up 2 percentage points in that time, to which some people just went, like, that seems absolutely mad. Like, what does it take to have an effect on this Conservative government? Maybe it's the fact that those sort of headlines, that sewage thing was very much like a Twitter thing and might not have actually been such like a headline bearer. Like, particularly when I was looking through the headlines, there were no headlines directly relating to sewage being pumped into the sea. So maybe it wasn't making its way through to the average voter, and the Conservatives quickly U-turned on it as well, so it doesn't have that long-term impact. But you are seeing in my opinion, you are seeing a Conservative government that continually underperforms, and even with stuff like this budget and taxes slowly coming through from that April one, you would think it would start to bite, particularly traditionally when you have inflation going up and wages not being in line with inflation, that old staying of like, it's the economy, stupid. If the economy goes, then you would expect people to blame that on the ruling party, or at least the party that has been in power for the past 10, 12 years. So maybe if those economic effects continue to have more of effect into the next year, you will start to see the Conservatives dip lower. But maybe more worrying for Labour is the fact that they don't seem to be a party with an alternative plan for the economy, or unfortunately, in my opinion, any plan whatsoever. They are, I've said this for a long time, but they are the only selling point they seem to have at the moment is that they are not the Conservatives. But I'm not quite sure what Keir Starmer's Labour stands for when it comes to an alternative plan for the economy or how you address some of the other problems post-Brexit and post-COVID. So I think that's why you're kind of seeing that although the Conservatives are dipping down and slowly have dipped down since their peak back in June, maybe they've all started to dip down. The Labour trend, it hasn't really gone up with the Conservatives. You're not seeing people flip from Conservative to Labour. I'd actually say that you're seeing more people either drift to the Lib Dems or Greens as a force. And you can always, it's a stupid trap to fall into where you can say like, oh, if you add Labour and Lib Dems and the Greens vote up together, they easily defeat the Conservatives in terms of like where the country is at. Like the Conservatives have a steady 40%, but you might think that like 55% of the country is actually for a non-Conservative government. But where they fall within that spectrum and how many people would actually vote Green come to a general election, you just don't know. But Labour will have to, if Labour wants to defeat this Conservative government, they certainly have to start getting votes from Lib Dems or Green voters, because otherwise at the moment they are just going to stagnate at a 35% rate, which I don't think I see the Conservatives dipping under anytime soon.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think, like you say, adding them up, they easily win. But we wouldn't do that because we know that those not all of them would come over. But you can see the kind of percentage shift to the Greens and the Lib Dems. And you look back when Labour and Conservatives in November last year were basically neck and neck. I think you would find a number of people would go back, especially when you get in the run-up to an election when it's like strategic voting is important to, you know, get Conservatives out as your local MP kind of thing, I think you would then see a bit of a shift back in the actual voting intention in the election. But the next general election is a long way away. So right now, I think we start, like I said at the start of this section, I think we're really kind of seeing where people's real voting intentions lie. And people who might, you know, vote Labour, because the question, right, is who would you vote for if there was a general election called today, is the question they ask. But I don't think people really take into account the idea of tactical voting and stuff in these kind of middle doldrums between elections as much. And it's only around the kind of the actual, you know, the local elections and the general election that we actually get closer to the true number. But yeah, polls to watch as always. Yeah. So thank you, Rob, as always, for joining me, giving me your insights into the budget, which I don't track anywhere near as closely as I know you do. And yeah, for having a look at the polls of me and for keeping us apprised of the headlines. As always, if you wish to support us, you can go to patreon.com/TTSS, where you can, from as little as a dollar a month, you can get access to bonus podcast episodes from all of our different podcasts. And you can get access to, sometimes there's behind the scenes stuff, things like that we share. But also that goes to helping support the web, running the website, paying for microphones, editing software, our recording software we use and things like that. So if you just want to throw a dollar our way, that's always great and appreciated. Please do. And of course, you can find us online at all the usual places, on Twitter and Instagram at Unparl Podcast, on Facebook as Unparliamentary Language, on Reddit at /r/unparliamentary. And of course, you can find us at our website, parliamentary.observer. A domain name I'm still kind of impressed they let me own, if I'm honest. I think after saying all of that, there's nothing left for me to say other than it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Ciao.
Bye. 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 Bye.
Hi. Have you ever wondered what would happen if you took the schoolyard conversation of which one of my favourite fictional characters would win in a fight? Well, wonder no more. Join me, Chris, and my co-host Matt every other Sunday for Mishmash Mayhem, and you can find out.